My castaway this week is a comedian. He's been making the people of this country laugh ever since he came out of the services at the end of the war and joined Oldham Rep. For 20 years, his show was a centrepiece of British television, as with his screen partner Hattie Jakes, he epitomised the naive and bumbling Englishman. He's a prolific scriptwriter and has also directed a number of silent films. Earlier this year, you could have caught him in the West End, playing a classic comic role in Molière's comedy School for Wives. A night of laughter is worth a year on the NHS, he says. He is Eric Sykes. Do you mean a night of laughter for us or for you, Eric?
No, I think it starts with laughter for me, because I think what makes me laugh makes a lot of people laugh.
But comedy is a serious business, isn't it, for those of you who make it? It's actually...
No, it's serious fun. That's been my philosophy. You can't make a comedy when people are not... when people don't like each other.
Unless you've got a happy company, you're saying.
That's right.
Or, a happy team of people.
That's right, and we had the happiest with Hattie Jakes, Richard Waters, Derek Giler. We are like old times. We were like a family. Hat was really like my sister, or my identical twin, as we had it. Mm. Because when we finished the series of six, I would go away and do other things, like a tour with Jimmy Edwards of Big Bad Mouse. And Hat would do some of the Carry On films. So when we met again, it was like coming home. It was lovely.
And it went on for 20 years.
Not the same program. No, we change it every week. But
but as I say, most recently you've been in the theatre in the West End, and you need this audience, and you need to hear their reaction in order to do what you do. But you have a problem, don't you, because you are deaf?
Oh yes. Well, it has been a problem in the past. Luckily, I've got these listening glasses, which help me to hear.
Just explain those. How do the glasses work then?
Well, it's called bone conduction, and the arms of the glasses vibrate against the head. Because I have no eardrums, you see. And the sound vibrates against your eardrum. You hear. When you have no eardrums, it vibrates against your skull, or my nose, or my cheekbone.
And this is why sometimes you kind of rub your eye by putting your finger through the lens, because there ain't no lenses.
No, but I've never had lenses in the glasses, because they are purely for listening.
So all these years we've thought of Eric Sykes in his horn rim specs. It's nothing to do with seeing at all.
It's nothing to do with seeing. I mean, I've got a dog in the wings for that.
Right, let's get down to some business here, and let me ask you about your first record on this desert island we're sending you to.
Oh, yes. I think Bing Crosby, I played golf with him a few times, and I thought, what a lovely man. We were brought up with Bing Crosby, and he was known in Germany as Der Bingo, and I was to do impressions of him. He got me the sack one day, because I used to do him doing When the Blue of the Night into a bucket in the cotton mill where I worked. And they used to stand around, and they all used to enjoy it. When the blue, and I did that in the bucket. When I took the bucket down, everybody was hard at work, and the manager was standing there, and he said, get your card.
My mama done told me when I was in knee pants. My mama done told me, son, a woman will sweet talk and give you the big eye. But when that sweet talking's done, a woman's a two-faced, a worrisome thing who'll leave you to sing the blues in the night. Now the rains are falling, hear the train a-calling, hoo-wee.
His mama done told him,
hear that lonesome whistle blowing across the trestle, hoo-wee.
His mama done told him,
a hoo-wee, a hoo-wee. Old clickety-clacks are echoing back the blues in the night.
Bing Crosby singing Blues in the Night, and that was recorded in 1942. You said in the past, Eric Sykes, comedy is a calling. You don't decide to become a comedian. How early in your life did you hear the call?
When I say one doesn't decide to be a comic, the audience decides whether you are going to be a comic. They're the ones...
But did you make people laugh as a child?
Well, I don't think... I think I exasperated people more than anything because... let me try to encapsulate it. It on my final report at school was inclined to be scatterbrained. And later on in life, our father told me that they'd never send me on an errand because I would have forgotten what it was that I was going for and I would invariably go to the wrong shop. I mean, it's no good walking into a tailor's and asking for a pound of beef. So I lived in my head. I lived in dreams. I lived in an abstract world.
But you wrote silly verse, didn't you?
Oh, I did. I wrote thousands of verses of doggerel.
Did you perform it to anybody? I mean, and make people laugh?
No, I remember sitting at the top of the stairs, very cold one night, and listening to my father reading out some of the verses to his cronies. And what did me an awful lot of good was the laughter that it was receiving. Mm. So probably little things like that did have an effect.
But this was, late 20s and early 30s in Lancashire?
That's right.
You know, the cotton strike, the depression. It's not really the kind of time when a young man might have contemplated a career in show business, you know.
No, I didn't contemplate a career in show business because when you were 14, you went out and you had to earn a bit of money. But it was a dreadful period of time, and when people talk these days about stress and strain, I think my poor father... what he had to go through to have to feed three sons, and he was unemployed for about 2.5 years. But I think I had a very enjoyable childhood because when we marched down the back, what we call the back between the houses, with a pole over your shoulder and a handkerchief hanging out the back of your cap, you were in the Foreign Legion. Mm. And I lived in a dream world, which was rather jolly.
And then, of course, you did sign up. You signed up, I think, into the army just before your 18th
birthday? No, I definitely wanted to be was a fighter pilot, which was impossible because in those days they had to be matriculated and they had to, you know... And in any case, I didn't pass the medical. I had a scar on the eardrum. So I was put in as a wireless operator. I became a mobile signals operator. That's a small unit that just goes here and there fast and hopes they know where they're going.
And it was, as I say, just before your 18th birthday when you joined up. It was 1941. Can you remember what you felt at that moment? I mean, did you feel frightened or excited or a mixture of both?
In those days, we were always taught to stiff upper lip and boys or men didn't cry. And I think I probably have only cried about 5 times in my life. But one of them was the night that I arrived at Padgate and had to get up on my bunk and sleep. And I just cried out of sheer homesickness because I was a loner. And to be amongst all this lot, you know, I knew the first time in my life I'd had a bed to myself. So it wasn't too bad. And I must say that having been in the war, it was the making of me.
I want to ask you a bit more about that, but I'm going to pause for your second record. Tell me about that.
My second record will be The Light Cavalry by Supe. And I think this is probably one of the most descriptive pieces of music I've ever heard, anyway. You can see the scene and the hillside. And down in the valley, there were the gallant 600 are all lined up on the horses. The horses are sweating up a bit. All the troopers are getting a bit dry-mouthed. And, all right, Jack. So, yeah, don't worry about it, Jack. You'll be all right. And all that. And up on the hillside, there's the families there with their tablecloths and their crest sandwiches and their wine. And they're all watching like this. And then there's the brass all on the horses up on the hill looking down on it. Now then... Now that they're walking their horses into position, and they're all now everybody's dry mouthed, and you can hear a pin drop. You can hear the buzzing of the flies and the bees, and down below there they are. That's nerves. Now pure nerves. Now. You can hear the tension now building up amongst all the troopers, the watchers, and even the Turkish gunners who are behind the gunners. You know what's going to happen. And the horses are getting a bit skittish. Right there. What's that horse there? Lad. Easy, lad. Easy. And they're all ready for the charge.
Marvellous. Well, that was the Light Cavalry by Franz von Suppe.
I think Richard Dimbleby would have done it a lot better in the old days.
Well, I thought you did it beautifully. And you were accompanied by the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Paul Paray. Actually, talking about action, you saw a lot of it in the war. What are your memories of it? They must be vivid.
It's funny. It's stupid little things you remember. Like, I remember when I was on the beaches of Normandy at D-Day and a few days after. I mean, there's still quite a lot of action going on. And I thought to myself, stupidly, like an American film, I said loudly, Saul versus France. By the time, because we couldn't get up past Caen at that time, that was full of Germans that were resisting very valiantly, but they kept landing troops in Normandy, so in the end we were almost shoulder to shoulder.
And the noise must have been...
Oh, the noise. Well, during the day it was pretty quiet and it was pretty orderly, but at night, as soon as it started to get dark, then it was a real noisy bit.
So you went on, as you say, to the siege of Caen. You went on to Lüneburg Heath.
Right, yes, we went through Falaise Gap, and we were ahead of the Second Army at one time, but then again, you can't have everything in a war. But anyway, we went Lüneburg Heath and he signed the peace, yes.
But at some point, you know, in this wartime career, strange to say, you began to write and perform comedy, or think about it anyway, and then you got round to doing it, I think, by the time you got to Schleswig-Holstein, I think, wasn't it? How did it come about?
Well, it came about because the Schleswig-Holstein, the war was over then, the peace had been signed, and a notice was up on the board, all those with theatrical experience, put your name down, and, well, of course, I put my name down, because it was either that or the cookhouse. And I went for this audition, which was given by Bill Fraser, who gave me my first break. And he said, right name, he sent me on a desk, and I said, Rick Allen. And he said, what do you do? I said, I'm Rick Allen. He said, I'm sorry, I've never heard of Rick Allen. I said, I used to do a drunk act for 8 minutes without saying a word, which, of course, was perfectly untrue. And he said, oh, I'm sorry, I don't know a lot about vaudeville. And I said, well, I'm Rick Allen. Oh, so straight away I'm in. Now, so I'm in then. We start rehearsing all the sketches written by Dennis Norden, who's also in there, you know. So then the first sketch they put me in, I'm a drunk in a French bistro. Well, I was awful. I was really awful. And a fellow called Gordon Horswell, who changed his name to Vic Gordon and Peter Colville, he said, no, this is the way to do it. And he tried to put me right. But in the end, I couldn't do it. So in the end, Bill says, I'm sorry, Eric, but you're going to have to go back to your unit. So as I was leaving with my small kit and that, I said, oh, by the way, I also was a member of a four-part harmony team. And he said, oh. He said, what was that? And I said, the Four Aces. Well, at that time, the Four Aces were very famous. So, and he said, do you remember that? I said, yes. He said, do you think you could get three other lads out of this lot and to make a four-part harmony? I said, no problem. So I was back in. But now Gordon Horswell, he said, well, he said, I've heard some cheek. He said, well, that's it. Because Gordon Horswell was a member of the Four Aces before the war.
So now the truth is out. Eric Sykes lied his way into the business.
I did, actually.
And then you came home and joined Oldham Rep. Let's pause there. Let's have some more music.
This is I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, because as I say, I love close harmony, and I was actually quite good at it.
I'm forever blowing bubbles, pretty bubbles in the air. They fly so high, nearly reach the sky, and in my dreams, they'll fade. Forever blowing bubbles, pretty bubbles, in the air.
I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, sung by the Merry Macs and accompanied in the studio here by Eric Sykes, my castaway. The person we've left out of your story so far, of course, Eric, is your mother, who died giving birth to you, but whom you've described before now as a guiding light in your life. Can you explain that?
Yes, because nobody ever really talked about my mother. She was a bit of a taboo subject at home, because I had a brother 2 years older than me who was idolized by that side of the family, my mother's side. And then my father married again, and I have a younger brother, John, who was 2 years younger. So I was right in the middle. And of course, he was the took center stage, and he was a lovely lad. He's still alive. I love him still.
But was there a sense in which you were blamed or felt guilty?
In a way, yes, in a way. And there were times when I felt almost like a lodger in my own house, you know. And you know the feeling you get when you say somebody's walked over my grave?
Hmm.
I used to get that feeling. And not long after that, I would write something good, or I would write something I was pleased with, or something. But I always had that little shiver before it happened, and I used to wait for it happening. And then the thoughts would come into my head.
Do you still get it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And when I'm in a bit of trouble sometimes, or a bit down, you know, I've only got to think of my mother, and it's just sort of a... I get the same feeling.
But you almost, I think, have suggested that she made a kind of spiritual intervention once when you'd had a big operation on your ears,
right.
I think, in 62. Tell me about that.
Well, I had the first operation in 51, and in 62 I had the other operation. Well, when I came out of that other operation, I was stone deaf, but absolutely. I was... So I couldn't hear at all. I thought, well, that's the end of my career. And I was really in a desperate state. Anyway, one day, the ENT man, John Ballantyne, was a very good friend of John Williams. And one day, the door of my room opened, and in came John Williams, you see, who I'd met before. And I said, hello, John, how are you? And he said... And I said, oh, you look great. And he brought his guitar case. And he sat by the bed, and before I could stop him, he started to play. Now, this is, you know... So I watched his fingers until he'd finished, and then he looked at me and said, oh, John, that was sensational. And then he started to play again. And he sat by my bed, and he played for half an hour. At the end of it, I'd said all the usual plaudits. Because I thought, here's the greatest... guitarist, the greatest classical guitarist in the world, and he's sitting by my bed. What a lovely thing to do. And I didn't tell him till 6 months later that I hadn't heard a word, because he laughed, you know, when I'd told him. And I was quite at about 5 days or something when I was absolutely stone deaf. So, and then I woke up one morning and I heard the rain. You see, I didn't think anything of it. The nurse came in and she mouthed, how are you? And I said, I'm very well, thank you. What a shocking day. And she said, yes. She said, the rain's coming down. I said, yes. She said, it's been like this all night. And she turned to go out, and she did the biggest double take I've ever seen. And she said, you can hear. And I said, I can hear. And it was a miracle. John Ballantyne, the ENT man, he came in, and that they examined me very closely, and they said, there is no medical reason why you should have got your hearing back.
So what do you put it down to?
I put it down to my mother. I put it down to a miracle. I put it down to there are more things in heaven and earth than I dreamt of syndrome.
Well, tell me about your next record.
Well, it's got to be my great friend, lovely John Williams.
John Williams playing Asturias from the suite Española by Isaac Albéniz. You began, of course, by writing. I mean, you wrote, I think, originally in the beginning, a script for Frankie Howard on Variety Bandbox, and then you wrote for Educating Archie and so on. Did you crisscross the line between being a writer and being a performer, or was there a moment
No,
when you...
I'll tell you how I became a performer, because, you see, Frankie Howard asked me, because he was the biggest singer in the country, without a doubt. This was before he met me. So the thing that I found Frankie Howard is all rubbish. He was the one who picked me out of a repertory company in Warminster. And by writing for Frankie Howard then, who was the biggest thing, other comics and got in touch with me, you know, and said, could you write for me? And
but it was unusual then, having become a writer, for you then to become a performer as well nationally.
That's right. I know what you're getting at. You're a very good prosecutor, you know, in a court of law. Yes, I will answer it. In those early days, I was writing one-hour shows, comedies, and they were live. And usually, by the time we got halfway through them, I hadn't finished it. So I still had one sketch to write while the show was going on the air. It was actually going on. So invariably I had to go on as the butler or a bystander or something and cue the other people and tell them what to do and do it. And it got through to the cameras that this is what I was doing. But in the early days, I never put my name on the credits. My name on the credits was Butler Arthur Pules. Or first bystander, Jim Thighs, or, you know, Jack Knee. Anything but my own name, until I thought, well, it's time I stood up and be counted, and that's how I came to perform.
Record number 5.
Now, the Mills Brothers, when we were doing the Four Aces stuff, that we took a lot of the Mills Brothers stuff, and all we did was got the gramophone record and dissected all the harmonies, because when you consider that these four voices were all beautiful voices, and they took the places of instruments.
With Caravan, and that was recorded in 1937. You met and married your wife, Edith, in 1952. You met her because she was a nurse when you had one of your ear operations, and you had four children. You've confessed before now to not being particularly active as a father of young children, that somehow you were a bit apart, a separate unit. Why was that?
Well, I'd always been a loner, and I had my work to do. I was very busy then. I was one of the busiest writers, because I was one of the first writers. And so the children came, they were all like little miracles in themselves, each one. And but I almost didn't know how to approach them, because they were so wonderful.
And was it difficult for them? Again, I've seen your son quoted as saying that it was very difficult when he was small, because he had a father who was silly on television, and he found it a bit embarrassing, as children
do. It did, you know, after a time. I mean, the two girls, I remember Catherine and Susan came to me one day, and they said, I was typing then, and they said, Dad, can we ask you a question? And I said, yes. And they said, well, why are you always so silly on television? What I did is I stopped writing, and I took them both by the hand and onto the lawn. We walked across the lawn, and after a time I said to them, I don't know where it came from, I said, we're all a bit silly at one time or another in our lives, aren't we? And they said, yes, Daddy. And I said, right, next time you're silly, make sure you're well paid for it. They had a bit of a hard time at school, you see. Had their father been Sean Connery or somebody like that, they would have been treated a lot differently. But to have, like, Hat as my sister and the bumbling way we did our show, it almost looked as if they really had an idiot for a father. And I've accepted that. It's wonderful to be paid for being an idiot.
Well, and you were at that time, I think, the highest paid idiot in the business, actually, weren't you, for a while?
Yes, I was, but I was always fighting to get the money up, because in those days I was always told, we never used scriptwriters before. And I said, well, you're going to have to get used to it, because scriptwriters are coming along and they're going to be the mainstay of your business in future.
You kept your deafness secret for many years, didn't you? Reading the old cuttings about you and so on, it seems to me that you thought maybe the audience would be alienated or wouldn't be very sympathetic if they thought you were deaf.
No, I didn't. I think they're very sympathetic. They've always been sympathetic. In other words, when I've been on, they've always tried to laugh louder so that I can hear. But what I was worried about was that people who put shows on, and the entrepreneurs and that thing, they said, well, we don't want him, he's deaf.
Mm.
And there was that.
And these days your sight isn't very good either, is it? What have you got, peripheral vision? Or?
No, it's something, it's called latimus something or other. I'm not sure that's an affliction of the chest, but everything's in squiggles, the bit of vision I have.
So how do you manage on the stage?
Oh, very good. I have to have somebody to take me onto the stage, you know, on the side, which is rather gloomy. And I just go in the door, and that's fine. Once I'm on the stage, I'm all right. But somebody has to take me around the back for every entrance and wait for me for every exit.
Do you feel resentful? Do you think you have more than your fair share of disabilities?
No, I don't. I always think it's there to test me. It's, you know, can you get over this one? Well, I figure out now I can get over everything except death. And, you know, I'll have a serious go at that.
More music.
Oh, yes, Sweet Banana. Well, we've done many shows in Zimbabwe. We spent a lot of time with the King's African Rifles, and they brought their band to play, actually, for us. This was one of the songs that they sang, and it's a wonderful thing to listen to.
Arearo, arearo, buy you a sweet banana.
Sweet Banana, sung and played by John Edmund and the Rhodesian African Rifles Regimental Marching Band. You've made several silent films, Eric. Was it, you know, most famously The Plank, I should say. Was it as a result of the deafness, or was it because, you know, visual humour is very much your thing?
I would say it was because of visual humour. I was greatly influenced by Laurel and Hardy, and I loved all those visual things that they did. I loved the two of them, because when they walked down the street, the sun was shining, they had a swagger about their gait, but you knew that they were doomed to failure.
You don't slow up, though, do you? I mean, you're 74?
Yes.
Why don't you give yourself a break? Don't want one.
No, they'll tell me when it's time to go. My mother and whoever else is looking after my destiny, they'll tell me to say, it's time to hang up your red nose or whatever, or your explodable boots. I've got these films. I've got a silent that I'd like to do with Bob Hoskins, which is almost ready, but we'll have to do it in the summer because it's a sunny one. And so I have all these things that I'm desperately keen to do and excited about them.
But you could afford to stop, couldn't you?
I don't know about that. I haven't talked to... We don't have bank managers now, do we? No, I haven't talked to the computer about that, but I think I could, you know, if the matron's very good and she looks after me. She doesn't know I'm here. She thinks I'm going to walk across the lawn.
Record number 7.
This is Jack Parnell. You see, every person that I know, like Peter Sellers, Johnny Spate, myself, we all started off, or tried to start off our career as drummers. I always, and Jack Parnell was the orchestra leader in those days as well, and he could play Bach too. He went nutty studying Bach. He's a great guy, Jack. I spoke to him and said, what I want to hear is when you were with the Ted Heath band, you see, because I introduced Jack to Mel Tormé. He said he's been with Ted Heath. And he said, he's a politician, isn't he? And I said, well, I don't know about that, but he's also got a band. And Jack Piner was a drummer in that, and he's a really great guy.
Ringdem Bells, performed by Ted Heath and his band with Jack Parnell on drums.
Oh, what a drummer. We were never in that class, but what
50,
a great guy.
50 years old, that record is amazing,
yeah.
Isn't it? What about comedy today? Who makes you laugh?
Joe Pasquale. Eddie Izzard is probably one of the great ones. And I think he's rather clever. He doesn't do a lot on television. But
I thought you had a soft spot for Victoria Wood.
Oh, yes, I think she's lovely. And I think she's so clever, Victoria Wood, but funny with it.
Mm.
And also, I mean, when she sits down and plays a piano and things like that, it almost looks as if, like, she didn't really want to play in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not quite sure of her talent.
Mm.
But it is there in a great abundance in spades.
But would I be right in saying that sums up your kind of humour, and therefore the kind of humour you like, which is that it is quite gentle, it's very warm, and it's kind of, it's not hopeless, is it? There's a kind of optimism.
No, the sun is always shining and there's a pot of gold just round the corner. That's what it's all based on. And wouldn't it be nice if the world was like that? Oh, yes.
What about your desert island? Do you think it will be like that? How pleasant a business do you think it'll be for you, all alone on a desert island?
I don't know. I don't think it'll be any different to what it is now. I think if something comes up in my mind, I've got to write it. But you've also got to have the other end, people to laugh at it. And I think I get very frustrated of writing funny stuff that I've felt that nobody was ever going to read or listen to. And you can't stand up in front of a bunch of palm trees and do an act. I've done it, mind you. Although they said they were people.
Tell me about your last record.
I think sometimes during the nights on this desert island, it'd get a bit lonely. So I'd like something to lift my spirit. What I've chosen is the Hallelujah Chorus. As we've had so much fun out of my life, all the records I've chosen have been chosen with love, and they're all a bit parochial. So the Hallelujah Chorus, it'd be fine. It all depends who's singing it.
Thank you.
part of the Hallelujah Chorus from Handel's Messiah, and that was performed, Eric, by the London Symphony Chorus and the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. So that's
not a bad bunch. Not a bad bunch. Now, I think I'd play that every night. And then anybody else that had animals and that thing, oh, there's a bunch of them there, keep away.
What about if you could only take one then? I suppose it'd have to be that one, keep you safe.
I think I would take that one because I'd feel I might join in too.
What about a book as well as the Bible or Shakespeare? Any good to you?
Well, no, because I can't read books anymore. But if I had a book and I could read, I was thinking that Ripley's Believe It or Not. He used to write all facts of things like a fakir in India who had gone around with his arm up in the air, and of course it had withered up in the air. That was the way he went round. And a bird had built a nest in his hand. Now, these are the sort of facts. They were fascinating as a boy, and I'd like Ripley's Believe It or Not.
A book of fascinating facts. And what about your luxury?
What I would like to do is to have a sandwich and a crate full of golf balls, and I could stick a palm tree up there and put a flag on it, a bit of my shirt on it for a flag, and try to hole out from what I would call a large bunker. But I'd have to have my guru. There's Tony Fisher, is an old pro who takes me out twice a week to play golf, and he looks where the ball goes and everything. And then I'd like to write to the PGA and have it put on the tour so that they'd have a match there, and eventually I'd have 18 holes of palm trees for flags, and no fairways, all bunker. And how's that?
As long as you've got a sandwich, you'll be fine.
Well, I should be for the time, you know, the time we're finished.
Eric Sykes, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me. Thank you, Sue.